Good morning, everyone. Did you guys get through all of the metal detectors all right this morning? This is a weapon of mass destruction-free zone. No smartphones allowed. We do not allow tracking devices in the pavilion. So sorry about the long lines out there. I might just move this to the side. There we go. Is this good? Seems pretty good. Okay, my name is Naomi Brockwell, as Jean wonderfully mentioned. Keep in mind, he is on stage here at 12 o'clock today if you wanted to come watch another wonderful Soho Forum debate. He does a tremendous job at those, and I'm very much looking forward to today's debate there. So I run a show called NBTV. It focuses on giving people back individual sovereignty online. I focus on teaching people how to reclaim control of their data and their money. So how to get out of the traditional financial system, how to reclaim control over your choices, your financial decisions, your privacy, how to do things online without feeling like someone's watching over your shoulder at all times. And today I'm going to talk about why this is incredibly crucial. So privacy is crucial for preserving a free society, and so many of our civil liberties depend on it. It is one of the most important issues of our day. But you wouldn't think so if you were to ask around, right? Because no one really cares about privacy. And it blows my mind because it really is the foundation of a free society. I'll go on to explain why that is. But first, I just want to get a gauge of the audience. Who here feels that privacy is important? Wonderful. I feel like we may have self-selected with this crowd. Who here takes active steps to protect their privacy? Okay. Mainly most people. That's good. Who here understands privacy is important but feels that it's a little too hard to take steps to protect it, so you kind of don't bother? Yeah. So that is quite common, although I think that this crowd is going to be way better than most. Anyone here not think privacy is important at all? Well, you attended a privacy talk, so this was not a surprising answer. So I'm going to show you a slide that kind of gives you a glimpse of what the real world looks like. Cato asked people whether they would support the government installing surveillance cameras in every household to reduce crime and abuse. And guess what? A third of all Gen Z polled yes. Let that sink in. I'll just repeat that. A third of all young people support the government installing surveillance cameras in every household. And they support constant video feeds of people's most private activities, so long as we wrap it up with a nice bow that says, this is for your own good. Who here thinks that's terrifying? What? I kind of come from this world where you talk about, you know, Orwellian surveillance, and we're all on the same page that Orwellian surveillance is a bad thing. And then you're like, Gen Z's like, hold my beer. That's a great idea. I just don't understand it. And it's not just Gen Z. It's not just the 18 to 29-year-olds who think it's a good idea. 20% of 30 to 44-year-olds also said yes. My mind was blown when I saw this. So this is the mentality that we're up against. How many here would support the government installing surveillance cameras in every household? Yeah, because you're reasonable people. Now, the idea is ludicrous to us, but I hate to break it to you. Many of us are already allowing this, along with countless other incredibly aggressive invasions into our privacy. So it turns out that we do allow the government to monitor using surveillance cameras in every household. We just don't realize they're doing it. Who here thinks that's a little scary? All right. So let's dive into what today's talk is going to be about. I'm going to talk about how surveillance has become integrated into our lives and how it's become normalized. I'm going to talk about how this is incredibly dangerous for a free society. We'll discuss how over the past decade, the line between the private sector and the government has become increasingly blurred, And what were once distinct entities have become melded, with few people realizing that this has happened. And importantly, we'll talk about why we need to start caring about privacy. This whole I have nothing to hide mentality, or you know, I'm too busy to care mentality, it only serves those who benefit from surveilling us. And we need to keep that in mind. So even if we feel that we're not special and we have no need for privacy, it is vital that we reclaim the narrative around privacy to protect those who do matter. You know, I strongly believe that all of us matter, but there are also incredibly vulnerable people in society, and us all caring about privacy helps protect them as well. So, finally, we're going to talk about actionable steps that you can take to safeguard your privacy. I'll go over some of the low-hanging fruit, things that you can do today. Like if you have homework today, just go, it'll take you 2 seconds. I'll give you a list of things that you can just immediately start, and that is going to help you reclaim a huge amount of your privacy online. So it's important to realize, just to kind of sum up this point, civil liberties hang in the balance at this critical moment in history. So not only do I want to sound the alarm in this talk, but I want all of you guys to sound the alarm too. I want you to walk away from this feeling like this is important and spreading the word, because it's only through raising consciousness about this that I think that we can really start to make a difference and reclaim this narrative. I want us to build a movement of people who are willing to fight for freedom, and you know, we're doing it in so many ways, and we tend to forget that privacy is one of the most crucial ways to do this. So I assure you, without privacy, all your freedoms will be lost. So let's get started. We'll kind of dive into the nuance of why that's the case. So, who here has seen this film? Some people are like, it's a very blurry image. What is that? So this is one of the most famous dystopian sci-fi films. It's called 1984. And we all know the story. Now that I mentioned the names, like, okay, we all know the story. It's a society that is marked by total surveillance and control. There are telescreens that record video and audio in even the most intimate of places. There are secret thought police that keep people suspicious of each other. It makes people self-censor. It makes them feel the need to make a public spectacle of just how much they're conforming to society's ideas. And like this novel, it takes to the extreme this idea of what a nightmare scenario surveillance can lead to. And then, you know, it's an enjoyable, obviously fictional tale, right? It's fiction, right? This tale? All right, okay, cool. Because after all, we would never allow listening devices in our homes, in our most intimate places like our bedrooms. Wouldn't happen. We would never allow cameras in private spaces that capture our every move and allow governments unfettered access. That would be insane, right? Facial recognition gives police a powerful new tracking tool, right? It says right here, but we're not in some panopticon that tracks us as we walk down the street, unless you count facial recognition software and BLE and CCTV and GPS and all the other tracking devices in our phones and in the street. And let's not forget those tiny little portable telescreens that we keep in our pockets with cameras and microphones that we take with us everywhere we go. And they see everything we do, and they see everyone that we meet. And these devices contain all kinds of tracking mechanisms. It's not just for tracking physical location. It's for tracking online activities. They track what we click, what we reach, what's in our emails, what we read, what's in our private messages, our health data, our financial choices, our mental health status. They're collecting all of this information. And depending on which apps you have on your phone, the degrees vary, but I can assure you there's a lot of data being collected about you. Privacy. Hello, Zoe. You're very beautiful. Privacy is being assaulted in broad daylight, and everything we do is recorded with unforgiving permanence. And that's something to remember. You know, it almost seems like surveillance in today's society far surpasses the most famous surveillance dystopia novel of all time, because they just had these big telly screens, right? But they could go out to the country and they were not tracked and all that. Like, how are we going to get out to country? In our car that has all these computers that are tracking exactly where we go? Like, I feel like, you know, it's kind of getting a little bit worse. But let's talk about the obvious differences between our society and this novel. This is, after all, a novel. One obvious difference is that in this world, the government is at the center of all of the surveillance, and it's carried out by force. Like, it's a very brutal society, whereas in our society, we're giving our data to companies of our own volition, and we often trade personal data for services and convenience. And we're pretty happy with this trade-off. Who often does things because it's convenient, and you get services, and you're willing to use a free email service because you don't have to pay, and that's better than paying, right? I mean, we understand there is a giant chasm between volitionally handing over our data and the government forcing that extraction of data. But I do want to dive into all of this, because this idea that we hand it over of our own volition and that it's fine, we seem to think that when we hand over our data, it's just a contract between us and the service we're using. You know, I'm just giving it to Google. I'm just giving it to Facebook. I'm just giving it to this map app. I'm just giving it to this dating app. That's our mentality. I have a contract with them. I want them to have my data so they, in exchange, can give me this free service. But it actually turns out that in the digital age, the government has decided that they should be automatically invited into every private contract that we enter via something called the third party doctrine, which says that we have no reasonable expectation of privacy if we allow a third party to access our data. So every contract where you're like, that dating service, this is our exchange, this is what I'm signing up for, you get my data, I get this free service. The government's in the corner being like, and I'm just going to sit here and watch it all if that's cool with you. And it doesn't matter if it's not cool with you, because they're going to do that anyway. So, you know, the entire internet operates with third parties. So the third party doctrine, it came about in the 70s when there wasn't an internet, and this idea that we were handing things over to a third party, it meant something very different. Everything we do online requires a third party, unless you're hosting your own servers. And like, I mean, the internet can't function without these third parties. So it's become the norm for, you know, companies to share bulk data with the government. That has been completely normalized. And then companies also sell our data to third parties, because they're allowed to, because we like click through the, you know, 60-page thing that says, I have permission to take your firstborn. And we're like, that sounds great. I'm just going to click OK. So they take that information, they sell it, and they're selling it to data brokers and advertisers and all of that. And then there are also the people who aren't even giving us services. They're just watching what we're doing, you know? They're just scraping data from the internet using all kinds of third-party trackers. They're just sitting there in the shadows, collecting everything that they can. You know, all this data, it's eventually compiled, it's put in these large data sets, it's sold all over the dark web, it's sold all over the not dark web. And guess who one of the major clients of all of this data is? The government. They're buying data. So in the US, we're meant to have a thing called the Fourth Amendment. We all know what the Fourth Amendment is. It's the idea that we, you know, we have the right to not feel like we're being searched in all of our belongings, right? It's the right to privacy, essentially. And we're meant to have that to stop the government going through all of our private information. And yet, the government is happily searching for all of our information anyway, and they're paying for it using taxpayer money. This seems very unconstitutional to me, but this has just, again, become normalized, and no one's really fighting back because we don't quite understand how this affects us personally. So what the government has learned is that they don't even need one of those scary George Orwell covers of a book with like a foreboding face, be like, you give me your data, or you're in big trouble. All they need to do is just wrap up surveillance in something that you want and, you know, present it as a product or a service, and you'll just hand that data over. And it's far more effective. Now, what if you don't hand over your data? Well, they have ways to deal with that as well. So Snowden taught us about a decade ago about the PRISM program, just one of countless government programs for surveillance. This basically gives the US government direct access to the servers of all of the major tech companies. And it's unclear whether this agreement with whether this is an agreement with these companies or whether it's a backdoor. It seems like it's an agreement from all the slides that we've seen, but every company has vehemently denied it and be like, I didn't give the government a backdoor to all your data. So, the jury is out about that, but they're still getting the data, so what does it really matter in the end? Now, in the UK, they have a program called, is that the right one? Yeah. They have a program called Tempora, which is a full take data collection program. What full take means is that every bit of data that enters or leaves the UK, any server in the UK, the government collects all of it. Every single thing that enters or leaves the country. And because America has these pesky constitutional, you know, rights, amendments, things that get in the way of their data collection, it's fine because by using Tempora, they're not doing the collecting. The UK government is, and they just happen to all be members of the Five Eyes, which means they have all these wonderful reciprocal relationships for the collection of data. So that's great. We've got the fact that government censors are literally posted at social media companies. Who read through all the Twitter files? That was an interesting read. If you didn't read through the Twitter files, I mean, I studied this surveillance for a living, and I was still blown away by the fact that they were having, like, permanent FBI agents stationed at Twitter to flag tweets in real time during elections to make sure no one had anything wrong to say. We can't allow wrongthink on Twitter. And then we saw these screenshots where we realized that all of these agents and everyone at Twitter has access to all of our DMs with the click of a button. A lot of people just don't realize this. They don't realize that they need something like end-to-end encryption to actually have private communications online. They think if it's called a private message, it's probably a private message, right? It's like, no, that's not how the internet works. So they can just literally click on a button that says DMs, read your entire DM history, and a lot of people just not realizing this is going on. And then we have Ring cameras. Ring is notorious because they have intentionally sought out partnerships with law enforcement. They will happily hand over footage, your private footage, without a warrant. They've admitted to do this. I think they admitted to doing it like, oh, we did it a handful of times. The fact that they're even admitting to do it, you got to wonder what's going on behind the scenes. But yeah, so and a lot of people don't realize it's not just Ring, because I'm like, who here has a Ring doorbell? Yeah, no one's admitting it now, are you? Yeah, no one. So Ring, it turns out, it's not just like, oh, well, it's a doorbell. I mean, I'll see if someone's at my front porch. Why does that matter? It turns out that the microphones on your Ring system can, like, capture conversations 100 meters away. So it can, like, if you turn it up loud enough, it can capture conversations of your neighbors across the street. If you're in your living room, it's probably capturing your conversation. If you have a Ring doorbell, at least, now, when I first reported on Ring, they didn't offer any end-to-end encryption. At least now they offer it. It undoes some of your features. If you have Ring and you insist on using it, turn on end-to-end encryption immediately, and turn off sound audio recording. It's just one more thing that you don't need to be sitting there capturing all of your audio. And you still get the benefit of having a camera if that's what you want. So, you know, Ring, we did a video on Ring doorbells and other doorbells, tried to find, like, what is the most privacy-preserving camera system for your home? Whew, wow, that's a rabbit hole. A lot of these companies, even one that we discovered was saying it had end-to-end encryption. That's a real debatable claim with some of these. They were defining end-to-end encryption as encryption in transit. If you know anything about that, they're completely different things. If you don't know anything about that, all you need to know is that they're blatantly lying on their website about the privacy protections that you're being afforded. So these were some of the companies that we looked into. And then, who knows who this man is? You can read his name. Keith Alexander. He is the former director of the NSA. He is the one that lied to Congress and said, hey, we're not doing surveillance. And then Snowden's like, I'm just going to put these out there. And then Keith Alexander's like, oh, I'm going to go work at Amazon. So he retired soon after. He's now on the board of directors at Amazon. And think about Amazon. A lot of us probably immediately think, It's a shopping company. All right, so Keith Alexander knows what color underwear I buy. No, AWS, or Amazon Web Services, is the world's largest cloud infrastructure provider. By certain metrics, nearly a third of the internet is running on Amazon's AWS. That's a lot of data that Amazon is capturing, and the head of the NSA is now on their board of directors. What's up with that, guys? We've got to join the dots here. And then there's explicitly forced data collection, obviously. You know, we have things like census data. We have KYC for everything that ever touches payment rails. We line up in these brutalist lines to get full body scans that leave nothing to the imagination. We have all of our personal belongings x-rayed. We line up to be randomly assigned pat-downs. That what we put up with in society is pretty crazy if you start to think about it. But again, isn't there a chasm of difference between all of this which is done in the name of national security? After all, you know, I want to be protected and feel safe as an individual versus some dystopian surveillance sci-fi. There's a chasm of difference there. You know, their world is all about control. Our world is all about safety, right? Well, we need to look around us at whether modern data collection practices are actually about control. And there are so many examples that we can point to. So, I mean, let's just look at North Korea, right? They have a pervasive surveillance apparatus that gives the regime an iron grip on its citizens. The monitoring is ubiquitous. In China, we have a social credit system that converges you know, financial habits, daily activities, your social graph, into centralized metrics that determine whether your children can attend certain schools, whether you're allowed, you know, a travel pass to leave your hometown, if you've been well behaved enough to use the fast train, otherwise you have to use the slow train, or if you're allowed to book hotel rooms. All of this data that they're collecting is being used in this centralized control mechanism, literally to determine, you know, whether you've been a good enough citizen to live your life, or whether you need to be subjugated in a far corner of the country. That gets pretty scary when you realize what this data is capable of. In Nigeria, they introduced a CBDC. You've probably, who hasn't heard of CBDC? I know there are more of you than that. So central bank digital currency, it's all the rage with governments because they realized, oh, programmable money like Bitcoin, what if we took away all the empowerment and the decentralization and just put the government in control of all of this, put them at the center of all your financial transactions and use this for a mechanism for control. So every country in the world is currently experimenting with CBDCs. In the US, it will be rolled out sometime within the next few years. You can bet on that. If you want to learn more about why this is terrifying, just watch my channel. If you're feeling like having another existential crisis, maybe you want to have some nightmares, just come to my channel. We do a great job at all of that. But basically, Nigeria's already implemented theirs, and it puts the Nigerian government at the center of every financial transaction so that money can be more easily tracked, frozen, seized. It can even be programmed to be erased. You know, if you don't spend it certain quickly enough, they could program this money to just disappear. So they can completely control how these money operates. You know, lives are monitored and controlled through their financial choices in a place like this. You know, so we can see that data has already been weaponized around the world. Yet every country, even these countries, seem to claim that it's all for national security and in the best interests of the country at large. No one ever admits that it's simply for control. So you have to really start to, you know, think for yourself about this, because you're not going to get the answers directly from the government telling you what these programs are for. Now, what about in the US? Very different country to Nigeria and China. So let's talk about here, right? Is the government here just using mass surveillance for our safety, as they claim? Okay, well, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, even if you believe that, which is a giant, giant if. The government is not a single entity. It's made up of people. You know, if the government has that kind of power to track us and monitor us and collect our data, it's inevitable that there will be some rogue employee in the government who abuses their power. So actually, it doesn't even matter if you trust the government at large, you trust their rhetoric, you think these are good people who have our best interests. There's going to be someone in there who absolutely doesn't. And you don't believe me? Well, there are countless examples, like the police officer in Kentucky who used his insider access to law enforcement backdoors to hack people's Snapchat accounts to get nudes from women. I'm so glad that law enforcement has those back doors into things like Snapchat. Very helpful for those women who are exploited. And you know, then there's the NSA workers, who apparently they pass around nudes in the office of all the people that they've spied on. Snowden talked about this in his book, said that, oh, it's very casual, like, oh, I got another one, Bill, take a look at her legs. I'm sure they're looking at her legs. And it's so common that they even have a common term that they use called love-int. So there's, you know, OSINT, which is open source intelligence. There's SIGINT, which is signals intelligence. There's all these different kinds of intelligence used by the intelligent community. They coined a term called love-int, which Snowden also taught us about in his leaks, where NSA workers use their privileged access to surveillance tools to spy on romantic interests. Doesn't that make you feel gross? Like, isn't that just gross? The imbalance of power here, you deal with it long enough and it starts to really hit home just how sickening this situation is and how imbalanced power is. Now let's say, another hypothetical, let's say you trust your government completely. They're really great. Someone laughed. I like that. Let's say you believe there is not a single rogue employee in the government. Okay? You're still not as safe as you think. So look at this data center. You can see it in the picture there. You see a little glimpse of it. So they say that all of human knowledge takes up about 1,200 petabytes. Now, this NSA database in the Utah desert can hold an estimated 12,000 petabytes of data. That's a lot of data in perpetuity, right? That's a lot of space for storing our data. And we have to remember that regimes come and go. So if you trust your government, if you think there's no rogue employees, that's all great. But regimes change, and your data is forever, not just in this database, but in countless other databases all around the world. And there is no telling how this information is going to be used in the future. You're going to have absolutely no control over it, and everything that you release out into the world is going to be captured and stored in it for someone one day to pick through. That's something to keep in mind. There he is again, Keith Alexander, former NSA director. Looks very official there. Now, he once said the quiet part out loud. He once said that his ultimate goal for the NSA was collect it all. And it's a complete perversion of what the initial scope of the NSA was meant to be. But they were like, listen, we're really good at this. Let's collect everything. Let's just suck it all up. Unfortunately, we reached a point where he's basically succeeded in his aims. When he initially was devising programs to suck up all of our data, he's like, yeah, I want to collect everything. Today, he's basically succeeded. Your data is permanently stored for any future government to pick over at any time, or any future hacker, or any future, you know, alternative hostile nation state across the world, or a terrorist group, or some president that's turned autocrat, and he decides that he or she has a dislike for a certain segment of the population. This data is there for all of these people. There are data breaches all the time. Again, we have no control over who gets access to this. So just remember, it's not just regimes that change. Social norms change. Civil liberties change at any given time, right? So last year, abortion was banned overnight in 14 states. And some women went from immediately, they were law-abiding citizens, they immediately became criminals. So let's have a think. What other laws might change that could affect people in this room? You're law-abiding citizens today. Tomorrow, you may not be. What if guns are banned outright overnight? What if cryptocurrency is banned outright overnight? What if protests are? I learned recently, I was so shocked, in Australia, in a few states, but they banned protests, and I had to read it twice. I'm like, what? They banned protesting in certain states in Australia? But it was during the COVID lockdowns, and they decided they didn't want people agitating, and they wanted a nice, safe society, and everyone should just do what they're told. And Australians were like, that's a great idea. I'm going to have a beer. And I was like, oh, God, guys, you need to get a pork fest going in your country. Get some people who are motivated to change this. This is terrifying. So You know, and it's not just in our country. Like, we've seen all throughout history that instant and complete loss of freedom due to shifted social norms and civil liberties, it's occurred repeatedly. Who knows what this is? Anyone? Yes, it is the Berlin Wall. So the construction of the Berlin Wall in 1961 is separated East Berlin from West Berlin overnight. It resulted in the immediate loss of freedom for over a million people, including the freedom to travel, speech, assembly, association, economic activity. And those trapped in East Berlin had to endure this situation for 28 years. It happened instantaneously. Imagine, you know, having a family, half of them live in East Berlin, half of them in West Berlin, but you visit each other every day and suddenly there's a wall and you can't see them for 28 years. This stuff has happened. Who knows what scene this is from in history? This is the Iranian Revolution in 1979. It led to the establishment of an Islamic Republic and a rapid change in societal norms and personal freedoms, all within a single year. And women in particular lost many of their rights. It just happened within a year. That is a really fast change in society for things to just completely shift. And women are wearing normal 70s clothes, their flares and their little tie-up tops. And, you know, suddenly they're not allowed to show their ankles because they'll be stoned, right? So this sort of thing has happened repeatedly throughout history. Here, Hong Kong, once the bastion of freedom and hope. It was for years on, you know, I think Heritage and Fraser Economic Freedom Index, it kind of oscillated between like Hong Kong, Singapore, like the most free, economically free places in the world. And we kind of looked at it like, what a vibrant society, how amazing. And then China was like, yeah, we're just going to implement national security law and maybe just end this whole freedom thing, if that's cool. And what was the result of that? So immediate crackdowns on dissent, immediate suppression of speech, like particularly political expression. There was the arrest of pro-democracy activists, the disbandment of all political opposition parties, the closure of many independent media outlets. Suddenly they lost their voice. It was absolutely tragic. I went and did an interview there, interviewed the protesters at the start in January 2020. And you could already feel it bubbling, right? Because COVID lockdowns were starting to talk about that. China was already starting to experiment with that stuff in Wuhan. And so I was in Hong Kong interviewing protests, and I was so excited for them because they were making headway and they were standing up and they were, you know, really say being champions of freedom of speech and why they need to have these independent media outlets and opposition parties and all of this. And then they used or whatever excuse, like never letting a crisis go to waste, right? They used all of these crises to just crack down. The protest movement never recovered. They threw a whole bunch of people in jail. There is no formalized opposition there anymore because you're a major target if you go back there because they've just lost that groundswell. And it's amazing how easily and quickly that can happen. You know, the protest scene was really a hallmark of Hong Kong society for so long, and it's completely shifted now. So given the stakes at hand and the historical precedent, why don't people care more? It's a good question, right? Like, why aren't we just talking about this all the time? And I think it's because we haven't fully internalized the dramatic shift in society that's happened even over the past decade. So, you know, businesses used to have limited insight into our lives. So you could go to the Blockbuster video store and what did they learn about you? That you really like Jim Carrey. And you hand over cash and you take your video home and maybe you don't pay it on time and so you're like, oh, you get a late fee and that's noted in your thing. That's all they find out about. And the government, could they get access to that information? Well, they might have to subpoena the local Blockbuster store. They certainly can't backdoor it. They're not on the internet, right? So they have to get a subpoena to find out that you like Jim Carrey. It was just really difficult for the government to actually get access to information about us, and we weren't giving any information to any of these businesses. And now you think about how the internet has completely transformed this. There's been a technological revolution that has completely shifted this balance of power, and everything we do is tracked. Everything we scroll, even when you like scroll past something, that's being recorded, how fast you scrolled past it. Oh, she lingered a little bit longer. That might mean that she's interested in something like that. Everything we do is recorded. And don't get me wrong, I'm a technophile, right? I love technology. I am like all for the latest gadgets, but I want my technology to work for me. I use technology because I want it to make my life better. I think it has amazing power to do that. But right now, we're kind of blindly using it, not realizing how it's damaging us. And I think we need a bit of a wake-up call to understand our technology better so we can make more informed decisions. And as I said, at the end, I'll go over some products you can immediately just start substituting in your life that will help you, better choices that you could be making instead of just blindly using whatever's right in front of you. Let's put some other things right in front of you. If that's your default, that's fine. But we're just going to like put those other things right in front of you, and maybe you'll take up some of these alternatives. So think about society right now. You know, from the moment we wake up to when we go to bed, our lives are a series of data points that are tracked, stored, analyzed by entities all the way from the governments to, you know, multinational corporations. And our daily activities have all transitioned into the digital world. We used to go to the park to meet friends. Now we're probably going to hop online and have a nice group chat with a bunch of interesting people, and we'll share links. And everything's kind of transitioned online. So our lives, all these private things that we used to be able to keep to ourselves, are all migrating into the digital realm. So this phenomenon has given governments and corporations unprecedented abilities to surveil individuals. This was unimaginable a couple of decades ago. Our minds would have been blown to think of how intrusive government and corporations are in our lives. We're monitored both online and offline through CCTV cameras, biometric identification systems, data tracking software, our interests, our purchase histories, our political affiliations, our activism. Everything is indiscriminately collected at all times, and this is the reality of our digital era. There is a great video by Sama Burja where he explains how the internet has made us far more visible to governments and large corporations, but it has not made governments and large corporations more visible to us. That's a huge imbalance of power. This information asymmetry is crucial for control. And this is a technique that's been used, you know, throughout time, information asymmetry. So we need to think about our current situation and the information asymmetry that we have created in society and the potential for danger if that is abused. And has it been abused? All right. So, in the aftermath of 9/11 terror attacks, governments worldwide increasingly relied on mass surveillance as a tool to combat threats to national security. Governments cast wide, indiscriminate surveillance nets and capture far more than just security threats. They're capturing everything. And you know, there are so many studies that show this stuff doesn't even help, right? If you're looking for a needle in a haystack, and they're just like, we're going to add a bunch more hay. That's going to help, right? It's like, I don't think that's how that works. But that's what they're doing. So they also go further, not just collecting this information. They're purchasing huge amounts of data from private companies and from data brokers as well. In such instances, any semblance of privacy that users might believe they had when interacting with private entities evaporates. And suddenly, seemingly harmless information like shopping habits, search histories, social media interactions, all of this becomes fodder for government scrutiny. And on top of that, the government systematically weakens the privacy and security of its citizens, which also makes us vulnerable to hackers and other hostile entities. So governments buy and stockpile zero-day exploits from hackers so that they can get backdoors into, you know, any remaining data that's out of their reach. And then you have things like Eternal Blue exploit. Anyone remember that? So, yeah, one person Wow. So Eternal Blue exploit was an exploit that they developed. The NSA developed this exploit in Microsoft, and then they lost control of it. And then it was stolen by hackers in 2017. It caused an estimated $14 billion damages through things like WannaCry and the NotPetya cyber attacks. And this damage was largely done to private industry. And so when the government says that they're doing things to protect the nation, they usually mean the nation state, not the nation's citizens, because a lot of people were hurt in things like this. So in this context, the distinction between surveillance for security and surveillance for control has become alarmingly blurred, and the expansive and often unregulated surveillance practices raise serious concerns. We've already talked about the misuse of this data and how it can be abused as a system of control, but now let's explore another aspect. The very act of surveilling the population also changes the fabric of society. And I think this is the most important reason why we need to care about privacy. Constant surveillance creates a chilling effect. It stifles free speech, thought, action, because people fear retribution. And when people feel that they're being watched or monitored, they're less likely to express their opinions or engage in activism. So without private communication or agitation, without private communication, agitation and pushback against authoritarianism becomes impossible. So we truly tip the balance of power towards all powerful governments and away from the individual when we allow the erosion of privacy in society. And I think that's the crucial point of why privacy is important. So there's a great quote, a great essay by Juan Angel. He wrote an essay called Privacy, The Hill to Die On. He said, life in the panopticon of absolute digital surveillance forces humans to become shells of themselves, subjects who self-censor their own thoughts, behaviors, and expressions, even in private interactions. We don't want to change society in that way, so we need to start changing the narrative around privacy and reminding people that it is important. Now, the internet, originally viewed as an instrument of liberation, now has omnipresent tracking weaved into its every corner. It is fast evolving into the most potent enabler of totalitarianism we have ever seen. And it is essential that we safeguard privacy in this digital world because it's crucial for preserving an open society. All of the other activism you're doing here, and you're watching amazing talks from smart people, and they're telling you to go out and fight for all of this, there may come a day when you just can't fight anymore because everything you do, every action is being surveilled, and that has been turned into a mechanism for control. The government suddenly says, you're not allowed to fight for that. You're not allowed to protest that anymore. So they start targeting individuals. You know, we've seen that in the cryptocurrency industry, completely decentralized system, such a bastion of hope. If you're not using it privately, the government just targets individuals, which they've been doing over and over. They've been targeting the developers who are not anonymous. Any bigger point that could be held up as an example, they've started to target. So that's why privacy is so crucial. It's the cornerstone of freedom of thought, expression, and association. It is central to a flourishing free market of ideas and innovation. And yet, our current reality delivers the opposite. The erosion of privacy due to state surveillance, corporate data harvesting, knowing that privacy is the bulwark against the omnipotent state and intrusive corporations. So how do we preserve a sacred place where individuals can express, innovate, and dissent without fear, especially in the digital age? Is it even possible? Yes, and the first thing we need to do is take back control of the conversation. We need to stop normalizing surveillance, stop telling politicians and companies that it is okay. We need to stop justifying the overreach. You know, we're often told, you know, censorship and surveillance, it's essential for safeguarding our own well-being. We're told that all the time, right? What was that? Yeah. Well, I didn't hear that, but I just said, yeah, really, firmly. But whatever you say, I'm sure it's great. You know, we're told that this stuff is necessary for protecting liberal values and ensuring that those in power can effectively catch the bad guys. We're told that all the time. And many people, you know, they're so eager to demonstrate their moral purity. So they champion this noble cause and they proudly proclaim that they have nothing to hide. Who here has heard someone say that? I have nothing to hide. Who here has used that phrase before? Yeah. All right. So we need to call people out on this grandstanding. To dismiss privacy because you don't feel that it's important blindly misses the fact that countless people around the world do not enjoy the same rights. Surveillance and censorship are responsible for undermining the freedom and safety of billions of people every day. So don't dismiss privacy as a concept because you don't feel that you're in a precarious position. Privacy is essential for the freedom of these people in places that, you know, are not coping as well as you are. So in the West, we even criticize privacy tools for enabling criminal activity. Who reads the reports that say, like, cryptocurrency is for the drug dealers and the money launderers and the bad people? Like, you know, Tor is just for the dark web. All of this stuff. We hear these privacy tools be demonized. These same tools are crucial for individuals living under oppressive regimes. Compliance with the surveillance state is a luxury afforded only to those who are privileged enough to be shielded from the oppressive effects of this surveillance. So if someone dismisses the importance of privacy, remind them that not everyone is so lucky, and we need to fight for those people. And it's not just calling people out who, you know, lose sight of global context in the glare of virtue signaling, right? We all do it. We're all guilty of this. I do it all the time in other ways, you know. But we need to go further than this. So who understands the concept of an anonymity set? All right, this is going to be a learning moment. You know everything. I'm going to have you up here as my assistant next time. It's going to be great. Think of it like the degree to which someone can claim to be anonymous. So depending on the number of people that they're mixed in with, that's the kind of concept of it. So let's say you have 1 million people, and they're all put in a dark room, and they're all mixed around, and that you'd say, well, that's an anonymity set of one. Once they're in the dark room, we can't tell who everyone is. So if you point to someone at random and had to guess who it is, you have a 1 in 1 million chance of guessing correctly, right? It's like, I can't see you at all, I'm gonna guess. You're mixed in with 1 million other people. It's a pretty high anonymity set. It keeps you pretty private. Now let's say you have 50 people. Put them in a dark room, swish them around. What's your chance of guessing someone correctly at random? 1 in 50, right? So that's an anonymity set of 50. If you have 2 people that you put in a dark room, how great is your privacy? It's in a dark room, right? I can't tell who either of those people are, but there's only 2 of them. I have a 50% chance I'm going to guess it correctly. So we may think about not caring about privacy because we're not particularly interesting, which is fine, because, you know, we think it just affects us. But it doesn't just affect us. Suddenly, the people who actually need privacy, the activists, the whistleblowers, the protesters, their anonymity set gets really small because the rest of us are out here saying, we don't care about this stuff, I'm not going to use it. So, you know, if there are only a few of them who feel that they really care about privacy and they're using these tools, it becomes a lot easier for them to be tracked. So don't dismiss privacy as unimportant because you have higher priorities. When you start to care too, you're helping the most vulnerable people in society. You're helping amplify their voice when they try to remind people why privacy is important. You can back them up, but you're also helping to make them more private by using these same tools. So it's a huge contribution that you're actually making by switching to some of these privacy tools. You also hear the epitaph, privacy is dead, so why bother trying to protect it anyway? Who's used that before? It's dead. Why do I care? I give up. So it's a really convenient narrative, encouraged by those who get tremendous benefit from invading your privacy. And the fact is that it's incorrect. Privacy is not dead. You can protect your privacy. So we need to push back against these dangerous narratives. So I want to skip to the end. I want to just talk about some of the tools you can immediately switch out. Who here still uses Gmail? Okay, I'm just going to... Can't deal with this. All right, Gmail. Google reads all of your emails. They analyze it, they collect it, they store it, they see everything that you send, right? What do they do with this information? We don't know. They're completely opaque about it, but we do know they analyze the contents of your emails. They used to give third parties, actually, access, and I think it was 2019 that they were like, we stopped doing that, guys, because all these third parties were just getting access to all your private communications. There are better email providers that don't read your email. So Tutanota and ProtonMail are both great. They offer great forms of different encryption. Let me talk about ProtonMail very quickly. It offers end-to-end encryption, which is basically a digital lock and key that says even ProtonMail can't read your email. You're sending it to someone, only the sender and recipient can read it. But also, if someone's not in network, so between ProtonMail users, that end-to-end encryption works. But if someone from Gmail sends you an email, what happens? Well, ProtonMail actually then encrypts that with your private key, also taking it out of their reach, which is pretty nice. That's called zero access encryption. So there's like a split second where they could read it, but the important part of this is after it's encrypted, they can't get access to it. So if they get a subpoena or a hacker gets into their account, they can't read the contents of your email. This is a huge first step that you can take. I've been using ProtonMail for a long time now. I think it's better than Gmail. I think there are better features. I can password protect emails. I can have emails set to expire after a certain time so they just disappear. It's pretty cool. But then I'll also say that email in general is a pretty insecure protocol. So if you have really sensitive things, start using Signal. So who here uses Facebook DMs? Yeah, there are some people. I'm clocking all of this. No, we're not here to make you feel bad. We're here to say you don't have to. Like, I feel bad for you guys that you didn't realize there were alternatives that were way better. Signal is way better. It is end-to-end encrypted, and it's a much more secure protocol than emails. So then don't use SMS. Don't use SMS and regular phone calls, because that is, it's really bad. So who here knows that there are actually laws? If you're a regulated cell provider, there are literally laws that say they're not allowed to make any of their channels secure. Who knew there were actually laws? It's the same guy. My hat goes off to you. There are literally laws. So these lawful access laws, they're in every country. They even have this union to basically make the laws across different countries interoperable so that everyone has access. Every government in the world can get access to things like when you send an SMS, when you send have a normal phone call. So here's the trick. They have to provide an unencrypted channel. They're not allowed to make it any more private. But what you decide to put in that channel is up to you. So you can use your data stream, fine, that your cell company provides you. It's an open channel, you can use that, and you can use something like Signal, encrypt that packet before putting it into that channel. That's why something like Signal is so much better than SMS and regular private calls. You can do video calls, you can do voice calls, you can do messages, you can have giant group chats with 1,000 people. It's great. All right, I'm skimming through a bunch of slides. Let's talk about search engine. Who uses Google? Stop it! Just stop, guys. Okay, so Google, again, they're just capturing everything. You don't need to, there are better things. If you really like Google search results, just use Start Page. It's a private front end for Google. You can use that. I've got 1 minute left, go breeze through these, but also feel free to come ask me any questions afterwards. Start Page gives you the same Google results and it's more private. I use Brave because I also think they give great results and it's the default search engine in the Brave browser. Brave, that brings us on to browsers. Who uses Chrome? Don't keep your hands down. I don't want to know. Use Brave, okay? Just stop using, like, even Safari is going to be better than Chrome. But Brave is really great, so I highly recommend that you do it. By the way, my channels are 501c3. I have no partnerships, no sponsorships with any of the products that I list here. I just really care about privacy, and I want to know, you know, that I'm recommending the best tools that I have found through, like, working full-time researching this stuff. Thank you. VPN. You should use a VPN. It has major benefits. It's not just about getting access to Netflix shows when you want to trick Netflix, right? It stops every website from seeing your IP address. That's super important. So you should be using a VPN for everything. It also stops your ISP from snooping on your traffic. And who's heard of DNS? It's like a complicated thing. Right. So generally, your ISP is going to control your DNS, which means that they see every website that you go to. If you don't understand DNS, it's fine, but basically, you're sending them every URL that you want to visit. If you use a VPN, generally, your VPN is going to handle your DNS instead. So it, like, that just plugs a giant privacy hole in your setup. And then the final thing, just skip through. So we've got aliases. Start, instead of using a single identifier for all your communications, start using an alias. Have a unique email for everything. It'll all go to your same account. It'll be just as easy as using before. But people won't have this single unique identifier tying all your activities together in every data breach that's released on the internet. Same goes for your phone number. I actually use my pseudo great service. I have a million VoIP numbers. You don't even want to know how many telephone numbers I have. They're all VoIP numbers. No one knows my real cell phone number. I don't know my real cell phone number because I don't use it because it's completely insecure. VoIP is a great service just for not having that single unique identifier. And so that basically sums up everything that we're talking about here. So there's a lot of low-hanging fruit that you already see. You can just do and it's super easy. The things that I already mentioned. You're not just making your privacy better, but you're casting a vote for a more privacy-focused future. And you're helping people who are more vulnerable. You are creating a better world for future generations by helping preserve privacy today, because I seriously think that the balance of power has just tipped so far away from the individual at this stage. We have to fight really hard to get it back, but that fight is so worth it. We've seen 1984, we've read the book, we understand what that surveillance is, and just because the government currently is wrapping that up in a nice bow that says, this is for your own good and you also get better recommendations for books, that doesn't make it okay, because the dangers are just as dangerous as before. So thank you so much, and go and fight the good fight.